Hello, and welcome to Off the Books, where we surf the uncharted waters of accounting, finance, risk, and wherever else the waves take us. This episode is brought to you by Workiva, the one platform that brings together financial reporting, ESG, audit, and risk teams into one harmonious a cappella group that can make beautiful music together. My name is Catherine Tsai, professional asker of questions and lover of venti soy chai lattes. I'm looking forward to debiting a great conversation today, and I'm very glad to have you hanging 10 with us. With me is Steve Soder. Steve, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Catherine. Happy to be here. My name is Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. Looking forward to digging into some not old conversations, but conversations we've had on the show for a bit because they are super good.
Yeah, and specifically some conversations that we had with folks back at Workiva Amplify, the annual conference that Workiva throws. So what are we going to be talking about, Steve?
Well, so first we've got a conversation we had with Alan Wilson. He will introduce himself, but he is a repeat guest on the podcast and always has some terrific insights to share. He's going to kind of set the landscape for us a little bit. And then we're going to get to Josh Gertsch, Grant Osler, and Benji Stevens, all our industry principals at Workiva, sharing their perspectives on Gen AI, regulation, and I think a few other good things along the way.
Can't wait. Let's get to it. Why don't you remind everybody who you are?
Exactly. So I'm Alan Wilson. I'm a corporate securities lawyer at WilmerHale. I'm a former CPA who became a lawyer and I advise large public companies on SEC disclosure requirements, particularly as it relates to the intersection of law and accounting.
It's good stuff, which is why we love to talk to you because you're at the intersection of what a lot of our listeners are doing in their day-to-day work, right? They've got their auditors, they've got the accounting, but then they also have securities attorneys as they're working through all of these crazy disclosure issues. What are you seeing right now? There is so much going on from a regulatory landscape. SEC is also, I'd say, a little more aggressive than maybe they have been in the past. What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of just people trying to keep up. There's a lot of focus in making sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So as I continue to remind clients, it's making sure that you're not only attuned to what's coming down the pike from the SEC for new developments, but you're not losing sight of what's old that people are maybe taking for granted. I was on a call just before this as it related to RevRec, which is an accounting standard that changed several years ago. Yeah. But in fact, people are now revisiting it and they're getting staff comments and rethinking that analysis just as one example. And so the question is, have we forgotten how that those types of processes are supposed to work? Do we need to make sure that we have controls in place to ensure that we're not losing sight of, you know, the fundamentals, if you will, and losing sight of it for purposes of complying with the new rules that are coming down the pike? The other point is as it relates to enforcement. You're right, the SEC has had a much more aggressive focus on enforcement across the board and taking new and nuanced theories. So it's making sure you have the best hygiene possible. Focusing on your controls and procedures is the core of what you're doing to ensure that you're really performing at the highest level possible and building the best defense should you fall within the SEC's crosshairs. And hopefully that's not the case.
I hope not.
The risks that I've been advising clients are the ones that people are concerned about. How do we manage liability? How do we focus on continuing to improve as an organization? And if we're thinking about ESG, how do we build that into the fabric of our company without creating undue legal risk or complexity with which we can't comply? And it's navigating those challenges and really the software platform that Workiva offers and then the tips that people are learning from other companies, I think are all in support of that common mission of continuous improvement.
As you've been thinking through the conversations that you've had up to this point, are there any what I would call no regrets moves? As in, you know what, these are like a handful of very specific things that you can do with, you know, whatever limited resources you might have that you're not going to regret.
Yeah.
Anything come to mind?
So, I mean, if you're thinking about it from a technology perspective, I think if there are opportunities to leverage the technology you have to build automation and control processes in place, I think that's critical because the fewer manual processes you have and the better you can leverage technology, the more efficient you'll be, which satisfies both management's objectives for faster information, but also reduced risk of error in your financial reporting and controls. And so I think it's a win-win in that respect. Admitting there's always trade-offs as it relates to building in new technology platforms, but I think with the existing products people have, there's so many capabilities that are unexplored. There is no regret in exploring and taking full advantage of what's available to you in a software suite if you're trying to integrate your reporting.
It's a great suggestion.
Fantastic suggestion. Thank you. Can I go back to nerd mode
for just a quick second?
One of the things that we've been talking about, we talked about it with a few other people that we've had here on the podcast, is the SEC cybersecurity rule, we talked about that in the past, but for those who may not be familiar, that's one where getting your materiality analysis and your determination put together becomes so important because once you've made that distinction, then you've got 4 days to disclose it, and certainly the SEC is going to scrutinize that. that materiality analysis. But one of the things that occurs to me, Alan, is that under existing SEC rules, you also need to be disclosing material climate risks. Mm-hmm. You need to be disclosing material human capital factors. And now here's this material cybersecurity risk. Those are three things that are likely non-financial. Cybersecurity might have some financial implications downstream. Is this a tipping point for SEC reporting teams where people are going to look to them and say, okay, SEC, tell me what's material for a cybersecurity incident. Give me a number. And then the team's going to be like, well, there might not even be a number. It might all be qualitative. What advice do you have as we're kind of seeing this whole thing play out? We're putting those teams in a really challenging position.
It's incredibly challenging, and it's in a lot of ways unfair because these questions are really whole-of-company questions. And so what I think it underscores is the need not to have a siloed infrastructure and the need to have cross-functional disclosure committees and groups. Disclosure committees always had an important purpose as it related to financial reporting, but now I think you need to make sure that that committee is comprised of experts from other areas. So maybe before you had a cyber person, but they weren't on your disclosure committee because it was tangential 20 years ago to financial reporting. That's not the case anymore. They need to be on the team. Same with human capital. You need to think about your labor folks and making sure that you're making them from a whole of company disclosure perspective. Admittedly, they're still challenging and the qualitative factors are very hard and company specific, but having those roundtable discussions and doing scenario planning, if you will, and figuring out where the materiality threshold might lie for your company before an event happens is so critical so that when you're in a crisis situation, you're not going to the drawing board for the first time to develop a playbook. You already have one. And for cyber, what I'm learning with many clients is they already had in their cyber teams an existing cyber disclosure rulebook for states and others that had existing cyber disclosure requirements. So in some respects, those cyber disclosure reporting requirements from an 8K perspective have been somewhat informed or will be from the existing cyber disclosure rules that the states and others have had and the cyber response plans that companies already have in place. So it's taking a fresh look at that and building it into your collective process.
Got it.
So these cross-functional committees, how often should they be meeting?
I think it's routine. It's certainly more than quarterly. You know, from a financial reporting perspective, you have the quarterly process for reporting. But I think other than that, you need to have specifically dedicated times when it's not financial reporting crunch time to think through these other issues in advance and begin building those playbooks.
Okay.
And ensuring that they can assemble short order should an event arise that needs disclosure.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you, my past life as a practitioner, we would certainly meet quarterly. That was in anticipation of an audit committee meeting where we'd be reviewing the earnings release as well as the 10-Q or the 10-K. Sometimes we'd meet multiple times if it was a press release that the Q or the K was going to fall onto that. But what was so interesting, and actually I love that you shared that, is that if a tricky matter, an issue came up, maybe it was cyber breach, I use that example, we were fortunate enough not to have any, that actually gave you a little bit of an existing playbook. Who needs to be there? What are the things that we're going to think about? What are the decisions that we need to make? And how do we document that? And that's actually my next kind of part two of that question, is that it seems like as companies are going through those materiality analyses, cyber being really important, but I would say human capital and climate risk being another one, so incredibly important to have that documentation, because if the SEC comes calling, they're immediately, Alan, going to call you, presumably. You're going to say, okay, what have you got for me? I mean, what have you guys done?
Exactly. And even more important to that, I think currently with the enforcement regime we have today, is figuring out what's in your collective email that you maybe don't know about. So if an SEC comes knocking, in your example, they'll be looking for all historic emails looking back over a long period of time. And you want to be thoughtful about what's in there as it relates to your commitment to DE&I initiatives, human capital, those types of things that you maybe didn't have a formalized plan for, but you have talked about for years. And so that informs how the SEC will view your company's perspectives on these things and whether or not that, in fact, may have triggered a materiality determination, even if it wasn't part of a formal plan.
Yeah, yeah. And spoiler alert, yesterday in the SEC Pro session, we were actually talking about the new climate letters, another round of climate comment letters getting sent out again. And that's another great example where the SEC could be asking, hey, you said this in your sustainability report. You didn't say it in your Q or K. Help us understand why the difference. Inherently, as a company, you're going to argue because it wasn't material. Okay, where's the documentation? Show me the analysis.
Exactly. And on that, I cannot underscore for everybody enough the importance of putting in your sustainability reports what you mean when you say material and pointing it to not an SEC definition of materiality. And if you don't have that qualifier, it's very hard to argue out of. There's a different definition, whether you're looking at TCFD or the SASB guide, as compared to the traditional securities law materiality, and making that distinction very clear is critical, particularly when you don't have other guidance from the SEC to the contrary.
So important, so insightful. All right, we could get back to the casual stuff. I've had my nerd out. Captain's like, holy cow, I need
no,
a nap
here. No, this is
here.
Great because the cybersecurity issue is one that a lot of questions have come up.
Yeah, it's new. I had a question because you're saying they'll go through your emails. As somebody who leans overly finicky and deletes all my email, like a very clean inbox, should I stop doing that then if that's...
So it's key to have a document retention policy okay. that talks about what you do as it relates to email archive. And I will say, I'm not a tech guy by any stretch, but I do realize that even if you delete them from your inbox, 9 times out of 10, they're on a server somewhere.
Okay,
that can
be
deleted.
Yeah, I'm not deleting out of like, oh, I don't want the SEC to find this
nothing
stuff.
Nothing is, exactly, yeah, nothing is ever permanently deleted.
For sure.
Yeah, but you know what, though? Honestly, I would say this to you and to anybody in corporate America, the presumption always has to be that whatever you are sending, whether it is email, Slack, heck, even text and you know, that's a whole other thing, assume that that will be read by a regulator or a general counsel or, you know,
so
somebody
dirty
else.
Business on Signal.
Yeah, sure.
You gotta keep the dad jokes, I guess, out of my email. I don't know.
I mean, look, and they can be blown so out of context, and that's the hard part with these communications, because they will be blown up on a slide by some enforcement attorney who highlights 3 clauses in an entire paragraph that completely distorts your meeting. So being extra thoughtful is always key.
100%.
I'm never thoughtful.
Good to know.
We need to revoke your team's privileges on a thing.
That's right. Somebody shut off microphone. Get Slack, please. Well, thank you to Alan. Always great to hear from him. Catherine, do you know what I really like about Alan Wilson?
What's that?
He is articulate. He knows a ton. And I'd say classically handsome. I don't know. He's going to be embarrassed if I say that. But always great to talk to. We are anxious to get to our industry principles, but before we do that, let's take a quick commercial break.
Once I hit my late 30s, I knew I had a serious decision to make. I could either get weirdly into World War II history, learn an absurd amount about wine, or start collecting vinyl records. Since I was never one for memorizing facts, and I think wine is best paired with, well, more wine, I started collecting albums. And yes, dear listener, the feel of a tactile piece of music is great in your hands. And yes, the sound really is warmer with all the pops and crackles underneath as Fiona Apple or Tom Petty warble through my apartment. But record collecting is complicated. First, there's choosing a categorization method. Do you go straight alphabetical or split by genre or year? And what if people you live with don't care about any system and like a monster, they put Orville Peck's Pony right next to A Tribe Called Quest's Low End Theory? Then there's tracking album prices. They can fluctuate more than the stock market. You have to know where and when to buy that Carly Rae Jepsen you've been coveting. I wish there was a Rekiva for vinyl, a unified platform to put all that vital financial reporting, ESG, and audit and risk info in one spot, and know what the most up-to-date facts and figures are. Dashboards to help you understand where your albums are by genre and year, and linked numbers and narrative to track a musician's career as they hop through various bands. Wouldn't that be great? Doesn't that sound lovely?
Welcome back. We just heard from Alan Wilson of WilmerHale, but it'd be good to get an industry perspective as well. So let's hear from our industry principals. Steve, who are we going to hear from?
Yeah, so we are first going to hear from Grant Osler. Grant has a ton, decades, in fact, of experience in audit and risk. Following Grant, we're going to hear from Benji Stevens. Benji is actually a banking expert, has spent a ton of time in the banking space, thinking about risk, thinking about capital, and thinking about how you report all those things. And then finally, we will hear from Josh Gertsch. Josh has been a repeat guest multiple times on the podcast, but comes with a very strong audit background, led a team of accountants and FP&A professionals, and he's going to focus a little bit on GenAI regulation and everything else with Grant and Benji. So let's get right to it, starting with Grant.
Is there a certain regulation either that's recent or coming in the future that people are kind of freaking out about?
Everybody that we talk to here in North America is worried about the SEC and what's going to come. And that the uncertainty, we're people, right? Uncertainty is not our happy place. So uncertainty is a big deal on the SEC. For companies and organizations that fall under CSRD because they've got significant operations in Europe, that's got everybody's attention.
Sure.
Some of them would take a little longer, but I think right now everybody's kind of got their eyes big and wide going, how are we going to get there? I think those are the two big ones. You know, California just dropped some new regs. I haven't had a lot of conversations with companies from California since then, but I'm sure there's a little bit of a, okay, now what does this mean to us?
Right.
We're talking about ESG regulations, or proposals
all these ESG stuff. So In addition to that, like we just had the SEC drop cybersecurity disclosures, right? So a lot of people are like going, okay, how am I going to do that, right? And this concept, and Catherine, you know, I know Steve has talked to you about this, but, you know, I've got 72 hours, I've got a report. Once I determine, it's like, well, how much latitude do I really have? How fast do I have to rush through this? And what does that really mean to me? And what process do I have in place? Do I have a good incident management process in place that really helps me do this? Because they're not very flexible. They're not forgiving.
And we had a kind of almost instant case study after that cybersecurity ruling dropped because there's the hack in Vegas, but MGM, Caesars, and Aria, I think, right. all got hit.
Yep.
Right? Do you... We didn't plan on talking about this, but yeah. Do you know how each of these kind of entities dealt with it? Do you know if they handled it well or if some were like...
You know, I don't know enough to speak about how well or how poorly that they might have handled it. But I think, to your point, it was a wake-up call to everybody. It's like, hey, no one's immune.
Right.
And you know, I think I've been talking with people about cyber a lot for probably the last 5 or 6 years, right? Ransomware's kicked it up a few years back, and it just keeps amping up. And it was a hot topic before then, but it's just significantly gaining traction and speed, it seems like.
What makes it different for banks to be worried about those versus any other industry?
Banking is quite an interesting area. Well, first of all, there's a lot of public interest in banking, right? Because everyone out there want banks to be safe and sound, right? And then government's also very interested in it because banking has a long way of shaping the economic landscape, and then impacts there kind of trickles down to almost every household and every company. So whatever happens is that in that sector carries a lot of weight, right? And more so with a crisis and how things kind of shaped around, people were a bit scared around, is this similar to 2008? Are we all going to lose our jobs? Is this going to be a contagion? So that makes it a bit unique, right, in terms of how banks looks at risk and all the stuff that comes with it.
Money talks. People are interested in money.
Yes.
People are interested in money. Well, and actually on that note, so, you know, several months have passed since the banking crisis kind of hit, and I know you pay a lot of attention to it, but for those who maybe haven't paid attention, how have things changed behind the scenes since the banking crisis, and how do we expect them to change in the future?
Behind the scenes, there's been a lot of attention on making sure that, especially within the C-suite discussions, making sure that they have the right tools to stay on top of all the risk. And what are the tools of the future that could come in to help make the work of the CRO easier, the work of the CFO easier, and the work of the CEO easier, right? So those discussions are going on behind the scenes. And there's a lot of also, in addition to that, there's a lot of talk around to what extent should regulation change, right? Should we have more regulation or should we have less regulation? There's a lot of political angles to this, right? Some want more, others want less. How do we find a right balance so that regulation doesn't stand in the way of banking and making banking safer and sound? So finding the right balance is a lot of talk behind the scenes because regulation comes more costs. You have to hire more people that have more processes. Got to submit a lot of reports to the regulatory bodies.
It is maybe the right question, not so much do we need more regulation, but do we have the right regulations in place and do we have to tweak and modify, which, you know, the way regulation kind of works is you get a bunch of new stuff and then you don't necessarily get rid of the old stuff. But is that really the heart of what needs to be happening right now is to think about, okay, is this the right set or are some things less helpful and new things would be more helpful and we kind of like swap that out? I mean, would that be like the most effective way to think about?
I think you're spot on that because if you use the Silicon Valley scenario as an example, post Silicon Valley Bank, post the crisis, the FRB came out with over 100-page self-assessment, looking at what happened, looking at the conditions prior to, the conditions during, and after, and assess whether did the oversight and supervision, was it done right? Was it done timely? Every time they can hire out there and the banks to come out and say, is this too much or too little? And so there's a commentary, and then eventually about 6 months time after that, they kick out a commentary and a feedback, and then come up with an appropriate right set of regulation. But it's still on paper until the regulation goes into effect and you see whether is it a cumbersome process or it's not, and things of that nature.
You know, if you look at all the regulation that's coming or what everybody is doing, or speaking broadly, like the entire universe of things that you could report combined ESG and financial reporting, nobody could possibly do that.
No.
And so you've got to be able to kind of do that materiality analysis and the prioritization of like, well, this is what's most important. And if I am to do this, let me walk backwards and look at the tech and the process and the people and start to like tackle one of those things, because then I can start to build other things onto it, right? And start to expand the, you know, the outcome.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is I would say, and so you've got, I mean, really it's, you can almost look at it like a maturity model, like where are you on this spectrum? I mean, at some point you want to automate everything over here, but like, where are you at? Like, where are you struggling? How do you kind of get through it? I would say even like a year ago, like people just didn't have the roadmap. They didn't understand, like, it was like all of a sudden, like ESG brought all this like non-financial reporting into it. Like now we got to assess all like a whole different data set that honestly we've never dealt with before. And so everyone was just trying to like grasp it, like just defining it. And where we're kind of where I see it today is like, hey, we kind of figure out like what matters in that kind of arena. And like it's kind of laid out. I think people can like visualize that. They can understand it. They can connect the dots a lot better than they could a year ago, quite frankly.
Gotcha.
You know, I would say that's the biggest kind of shift is people are more comfortable with it. They kind of can see a vision. They kind of can see the need of how everything's going to be intertwined. And basically, like, what you're really doing is trying to automate everything across all stakeholders and all reports and all that. And I think that vision is there probably more than it's ever been, you know?
All right. Well, Catherine, there was certainly a lot there. What stuck out to you?
A little bit of sass and a lot of good tidbits for action items to take back to the team, I think.
No shortage of sass on that team, I can assure you.
Well, I also want to hear from them on some of the other hot topics of the day, maybe just one big one, which would have to be generative AI.
It definitely would, and they all had quite a bit to say. We're going to start off with Grant again. Let's see what he had to say about Gen AI.
I also wanted to ask you about another hot topic, generative AI. What are you hearing from folks at Amplify?
Huge buzz, huge excitement. I think it's transitioning now from a novelty, something I do at home with ChatGPT to go, oh yeah, I can really do this in my work and it can help me, but I've got to do it right. You know, so I for me, as again, I'm an audit controls guy by background, right? And risk is like, it's an incredibly powerful tool. It's not gonna do everything for you, right? But it gives you data and helps you get through things faster, so you can make informed decisions and really understand it, I think.
Sure.
But to say, hey, I can't just squeeze the loose. I'm mitigating this risk by taking in this AI, but I'm doing an insecure, so I just created a new different risk for me. I can't do that. I've got to be able to do this without creating a new risk that I now have to manage.
Yeah, you don't want to play whack-a-mole with your risk.
Exactly. So I got to be in a situation, hey, look, I can now do this in a secure environment where I know that they're not learning on my stuff, right? All of those things help me get faster and better at what I do so I can accomplish more. I mean, I work with internal audit teams a lot, right? And they're being asked to do more, to add more value, not just provide compliance. And so chat's a great, or generative AI is a great way to move forward in that, but I've just got to do it the right way. Because when you're the risk person, you can't be the one who screws it up.
Right.
Right? So.
Is there any, I don't know how much you played with Gen AI in general, but is there any words of wisdom, advice to somebody who's like scared to start?
So I've played with it, not as much as some have, but I've played with it a fair amount. I think what I'm learning is it's a lot of times it's more how I ask the question than what I ask.
Prompts matter.
So really learning to prompt manage and say, hey, okay, and so it's like, ask the question, ask it six or seven different ways.
Sure.
And say, which of these make the most, and say, what's consistent? That's probably pretty legit. This is different. Why didn't that come up with these other ones? And so again, it's that critical eye on, can I rely upon, is this a hallucination? Is this real? Right? And then be able to get back, I got to somehow get that back to the source, say, hey, where did this come from? Is it a reliable source? Or is this, you know, is in Wikipedia?
Right.
Well, do I trust Wikipedia? That's the age-old question, right?
When I taught college, those kids definitely trust Wikipedia too much.
So, you know, it's like they said, well, who are they? Yeah. I don't know.
Them.
Yeah. They did, though. I'm pretty sure they said that. Well, no.
What sorts of questions have you gotten at the conference from attendees?
Attendees, they're looking for more information on how to manage data.
Uh-huh.
Right. How do we make good use of data? How do we think of the right tools? How do we think of machine learning? How do we think of AI?
AI,
there it is.
Right. What is AI? What is it? What is not? What is data analytics? What is digital transformation? Is it useful? That's not. Those are the questions that are coming.
Okay.
Well, and I think that even outside of whether it's regulatory compliance, whether it's the use of AI, that's always been a really compelling question for banks.
Gen AI has been a hit. Everyone, and I don't know why it's a hit. I mean, let's just jump in. I've got a theory. I think nobody knows what Gen AI really is. So everyone's just asking the million-dollar question of, like, what is it? They want to know about it. They want to, like, you know, kind of get a sense for it. So that's been a big hit.
Even the legal audience is interested?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but so interesting enough on this point, the legal audience was, like, worried about it because it's like, oh, yeah, go out there and, you know, draft my risk factors. And they're like, well, does that mean I, like, lose my job? Because that's, like, that's what I do.
Wait, what am I?
So there might be a comp, like, I don't know. They want to know about Gen AI, but everyone's got some different angles.
Right.
Maybe to kill it or to buy it. One of the two.
You know? Well, I think that's what's so important. Hopefully people are learning is that it's very powerful. It can really help you. It is, in my humble opinion, worthless without people.
Yeah.
It cannot actually do your job.
Yeah. Other highlight, I think, you know, it's a tech conference. You think you get into, you know, what's happening with the tech, but all the focus kind of seems to be like, hey, technology is here to make, like, your life better. It's actually all about people is kind of the takeaway. Like, hey, all these things are great, but it's intended to free you up. It's intended to make your life better. It's intended to, like, save hours or critical hours, you know, here and there. And so I think that's been a kind of a cool takeaway that it kind of comes back to, like, what really matters. So it's not about the technology. It's about all, like, all the customers, like, everybody, like, finding something that, like, makes life better.
Well, that wraps it up for our conversation. Really, really appreciate all of our guests, Alan Wilson, Josh Gertsch, Grant Osler, and Benji Stevens for joining us and giving us up to date and reminding us of all the great topics we discussed at Amplify. And huge thanks to you, dear listener, for surfing along with us. This has been Off the Books, presented by Workiva.
Please subscribe, leave a review, tell your buddies if you liked the show, sound off in the comments if you're watching on YouTube, and feel free to drop us a line at offthebooks@workiva.com. We'll be back next week talking to Steve Cates, Chief Financial Officer of Westwater Resources. Surf's up, and we'll see you on the next wave.